Today's November 10th, and we are discussing the relationship between Jews and the other two major monotheistic religions. This is a class of Jewish engagements, and we start with Christianity, that we both revere the same Tanakh. Of course, Jews do not revere what Christians call the New Testament. I do not like to refer to this as the Old Testament. Call this the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh. And since they revere every prophecy in here, so it's a prophecy that refers to a redemptive age at the end of time, having a precursor of Jews being back in the land of their dispersal as well as in Israel, so they will support that. Right? And I'm not afraid to accept that support. Right? Is it contingent on us being fast for conversion so that we're ready now that we're in Israel, that it would be easy pickings for them? Right. The fact is, Israel is rife with missionary activity. Right. I remember the year I was in Israel, 1979. We actually did lots of anti-missionary work. So front them, you know, they know the Tanakh better than we do, generally. And they'll tell you a prophecy that looks a lot like Jesus, and how do you answer it if you don't know what it's talking about? You say, okay, I go away, but let me tell you something. When you talk up to them and explain to them that you know what the original Hebrew is, you know how they're distorting that Hebrew to fit their agenda, and you know that this is not talking about a human taking on a godly form, and you know that this isn't talking about a New Testament, then they'll pack up and move away. Follow them. Right? Because they rely on the fact that you are oblivious or ignorant. Okay. Anyway, here's the point. They revere this, so we contend with this. This is an issue. How they can revere it, but mostly not follow and practice what's written in it, is, all right, we can quibble that another time. But the more complicated issue here is that while Islam reveres some of the prophets in this book, they have rejected the book itself. Right? In the Quran, it is Ishmael who is the chosen son of Abraham, with Yitzhak being cast away. Right? Isn't this the same thing as saying that our bias doesn't have a Jewish presence? They say that we falsified our Tanakh. They made this claim while saying that the oldest Quran is from the year 600, the oldest Tanakh is only about the year 900. So you lie. You don't have an older Tanakh that proves that you're right. What event about 70 years ago very roundly disproves this? Not to mention other finds that the Dead Sea Scrolls. All the Dead Sea Scrolls, which contains the whole Tanakh except the Gilad Esther, the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, have Shmuel being sent away, Yitzchak being taken up to a mountain. But never mind the Septuagint, but the Christians is much older than the oldest Quran. They'll just say that the Christians changed the Torah. Right? Okay. Alright, but here's another important point. While the Christian reveres this book and the Muslim doesn't, there's another important point. If we had three experts in the field about the philosophical notions of their religion, a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim, right? To talk about the dogma of your religion, which two are going to sound very much alike 95% of the time? The Jew and the Muslim.
Jew and the Muslim.
Religious philosophy? Pretty much the same. Except the practices are different. They did not 5 times a day, they did not 3 times a day, they did not. Right? They have different mysteries. But I'm talking about simple Jewish philosophy. What do you think about your deity? The Jew and the Christian is going to be very far apart. Right? That God gave a law that he knew he would abrogate one day? And change in the middle of history and say you don't have to keep this law anymore? By the way, that's contradicted by Jesus himself in the book of Matthew. He says, I come not to change the law of Moses. Right? And it's such a famous quote that the Talmud quotes, of course, Tessayan and Sefer Shamos. There's a discussion about Christianity. Leo quotes that pasuk. Right? So, but that's the, And that God would take a physical form and walk the earth and divide himself between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. This is very foreign to Judaism. Very foreign. That the marital act is by necessity sinful, so that the only way you can have salvation is to believe in someone not created that way. Right? That all of our parents created us. That's very foreign to us. And why would an altruistic God put such a person in the middle of human history? You with me on this? You know that traditional Catholicism teaches that anyone born or died, or anyone who died before Jesus, didn't have salvation. Because they didn't have him to believe in. He altruistically went to hell and pulled out all the souls who didn't have him to believe. Why would an altruistic God make it that way? Make an Adam. Adam wasn't created through a marital act. Let's believe in Adam to get all those people before Jesus to have their salvation. You know what I'm saying? It's some of these religious philosophies are so foreign to Judaism. But if you talk to an Islamic imam and a Jew, we're going to come up with most of the same issues about religious philosophy, about the nature of God and the like. Okay, you see it? Okay. So I think until the 1640s, you know, the Catholics and the Protestants were doing what the Sunnis and the Shiites are doing to each other. It takes a religion some time to get out these kinks. We had ours too. Only ours happened in Tanakh, in the time of Malachim, the two kingdoms, and also certainly in the time of the Roman conquest. Okay? In fact, you might argue, if you're a good historian, that that's what weakened us to the point that the Romans were able to conquer us. Right? Okay, with our horrifically fractious attitudes one to another. Okay? So it would appear now that our greater challenge, although we would have said something else 1,000 years ago, 600 years ago, 500 years ago, with the Inquisition, expulsions, those were mostly from Christian lands. But don't be fooled. Don't be fooled into thinking life was always rosy in the Arab lands. It was not. Right? It was just in comparison to Christianity that it was considered better. Right. The Quran reveres a number of our great biblical characters, right? And what's interesting is some of what's in the Quran makes its way. It depends on which one comes first. But there are some interesting midrashim about some of our characters that have made their way, I should say, into the Quran, right? And it's just very. Yosef is in the Quran, right? Familiar? Yosef is very beloved by Muslims. Of course, everything is political today, so you know what they've done to his keter and shchem, right? But he is revered in the Quran, right? Mordechai and Esther are not revered in the Quran, but their tombstones in Iran were shrined for a long time until recently, now that they've sacked it. This is all politics. Look, you see what they do to, what Sunnis do to Shiite mosques, what Shiites do to Sunni mosques. Not just the mosques, but the hundreds of people inside them. And a lot of Qurans probably go up and smoke with them. So they're going to do it. They did it to places that they've revered for a long time. Right? Are you familiar with a medrash where Potiphar's wife is talking to her friends about this new Hebrew kid that came to the household that is so profoundly good-looking that she's losing herself every day? She can't help herself. And the friends say, come on, you're an old guy. What's the matter? And she said, okay, I'll show you how good-looking he is. She gives all of them, she takes about 30 women into a room and gives all of them esrogim. Does this sound familiar to anybody here? No? And she gives them all a knife. This is a medrash in the Tanchuma, Bereishis. And all the women, it says, okay, now peel your esrogim. So they start to peel their esrogim with this sharp knife, and then she has Yosef walk into the room while they're peeling the esrogim. And it says every single one of them cut their hand when he walked in the room. Why an esrog? Why not an apple? No, an esrog. That's the fruit of the Gan Eden, according to Islamic literature, as well as one opinion that appears in Talmud, right? And that story, as I just described it, is in the Quran. Of all things for the Quran to tell about Yosef, that's in the Quran. That's it. Who took it from whom, right? I will tell you, there are church teachings that amazingly come out of the Talmud. Let me tell you the name of a book. It's like a Kuzari book written in the 10th century. It's called Elucidarium. It's a Latin book, Elucidarium. Maybe you can make out the etymology. Elucidarium, which means that which clarifies, right? Lux, light, that which gives light. Elucidarium is a book with questions and answers from a student to his church father. One of the questions that the kid asks is, what did Adam and Eve do on their first day in the garden? That's not a question that has ever been bothering you. It's a kasha of Lamed Zayin in the Sefer Sanhedrin. And it goes hour by hour what Adam and Chava did from their first hour to the tenth hour. And amazingly, the author of the book is called, his name is Onarius. Onarius. And he writes the exact same 10 lines of the Talmud. Right? By that time, of course, the Talmud proceeds. He doesn't say, according to Jewish tradition, this is what they did. No. He answers the kid, these are the 10 things they did. Only he mixes up hours 7 and 8. What appears in the Talmud on hours 7 and 8 in the Elucidarium is 8-7. You probably want to know what is 7 and 8. So in our Talmud, line 7 is, they went to bed 2 and came out 3. In hour 8, they ate from the tree. The Elucidarium says they ate from the tree in hour 7. And then, so you could have said they had a baby. Instead, use the same expression. They went to bed 2 and came out 3, implying that before the sin, we were supposed to conceive and give birth the same day. Right? You know, Columbia Presbyterian in the 1880s, while the whole rest of the world were using chloroform to help women give birth, they refused to allow women to use chloroform and said, it says, gracious for Etzer tell people on him, you've got to give birth in pain. Beforehand, it was no pain. Now it's a punishment for Chava's indiscretion. You have to have pain. No chloroform for women. It took over 10 years to finally change that policy. Right? Of course, no Jew can give birth there for a long time during that time. But what I'm just saying is that they refused to move off of this. And it seems that they used the same lashon. They went to bed 2 and they came out 3. Right? As if they were just copying. I can tell when one of you is copying from the other. But they switched the hour. Explain to me why. Why would they switch those? They went to bed 2, came out 3, and then they ate.
What?
Yeah.
Can you
finish that? Oh, tell me, talk to me. Come on, listen. After the sin, it was a necessary evil. Right, so they want the sin to be before they conceive the baby. Right? And we say, no, they were engaging in the marital relation. It was just that before they ate from the tree, it had a different mahus to it. There was no selfishness. It was all an act of giving. It was all an act of purity. Right? So, but wait a second. Anybody have any kashas here? When all is said and done, chapter 3 of Bereishis is the sin. And chapter 4 begins, Ha'adam Yodas Ha'avishta. Christians are right. We mixed it up. You following? And Rashi actually, in his commentary to the Torah, addresses this very point. You see, the nature of biblical Hebrew is to say Vayeda ha'adam es chara ishta. But in Paragala it says ha'adam yoda es chara ishta. Now she says all these things happened very quickly. She was already conceived. Ha'adam yoda means Adam had known. Why does it record it this way? Because I don't want to have and then interrupt with the story of the Gan Eden and then talk about the babies being born. Right? Not the way that's not to do that. That's why Terach dies in Parshas Noach, even though he's physically alive until Parshas Vayetze. Right? We do that in the Torah. You don't have to cut up everything exactly as it happens. So okay. Just saying that there are these very significant philosophical differences between Christianity and Judaism, even though we revere the same text. Pretty interesting, right? So, just understand our approach to Christianity is just understand the most important word in this realm is the word shituf. Shituf. I don't mean any disparagement of one of the world's great religions, but basically our understanding, our halachic understanding of Christianity. And I may, if you have an extra hour, an hour and 15 minutes over the weekend, see if you have time to watch this. It's a film called Disputation. Disputation. It's with Christopher Lee. And he plays the King James of Aragon, who had just, before this disputation took place, had defeated the Muslims at Tours, and that one battle is what is credited with making Europe a Christian nation throughout the Middle Ages. So recently, it's changing now. But if not for this James of Aragon, which means he was very powerful, the church accepted and appreciated him, and gave him great powers, and to our benefit, to the Jewish benefit, while France and Germany were sacking Jewish towns and murdering all across Europe, the Spanish, at this time still, the seeds of the Spanish Inquisition were being sown at this time. But the Spanish at this time, in the mid-13th century, were still much more beneficial to Jews than France and Germany. And this James of Aragon arranged for a disputation between Ramban and an apostate Jew who converted and took the name of Pablo Christiani, Barcelona.
So, look at that. Based on one of these?
Yeah.
And he came to shul the next day.
After it was completed. Because he was very kindly disposed towards Ramban, even after it. And he had a very zealous wife, who laid the groundwork, as I said, of the Inquisition. But if you have a chance to do this before you answer the questions of Unit 7 and 8, it'd be very, very helpful. It really is. It's a very entertaining hour and 15 minutes. Right? It's very gripping. And it's called The Disputation. A lot of high schools show this. Right? It's a very interesting read on just a few quick questions of difference between Christianity and Islam. Right, so without disparaging one of the great religions of the world today, basically the traditional opinion that Ramban actually mentions in the film itself is that Christianity to us is exactly what the Egel was in Shmos Herakonovit. Does anyone explain what I mean by that? It's exactly what the Egel, it's what the calf worship in the desert was. Explain what I mean by that. Again. What was the angel after all? Why did you make an angel?
Manifestation of God,
physical manifestation of God. The God who just took us out of Egypt. Because in the absence of Moshe, who until now was our medium, the way we reached God, right? So in the absence of Moshe, we need something else. Rashi is probably correct Rashi, it says that it's the Erev Rab that made the Egel. Because they said, Eila Elohecha Yisrael. They were calling Israel. make this, make it. We didn't worship its God. The object of this worship is God, the God of Israel, the God who took us out of Egypt, the God who appointed Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. It's God. We're praying to God, right? And still Moshe didn't like it. Right? It was a big compliment to him because they saw him as their sheep to God. You get it? So that's what Christianity is. Jesus is the angel. We have a physical manifestation to reach God, reach the Father, whom Christians agree is not to be seen and doesn't have a figure and doesn't have a, right? Okay? So this is a physical manifestation of God. To the people in the desert is a calf, because that's what they were used to in Egypt. And to Christians, a human being. It's not idolatry, it's a type of heresy within Judaism. Okay, got it? Look, in Sefer Melachim, Yeravam ben Nevat set up two shrines, one in the north in Beit El, and in south Beit El, one in the north in Dan, right? And he set up two shrines and put up calves in these two shrines and also announced, these are the gods who took you out of Egypt. How can he make such a mistake? How can he exactly use the same lashon that the Torah used with the angel? Some Bible critics try to prove from here that the reason why he did is because he didn't know the story of Shmos. Shmos hadn't happened yet. I reject this. If you think that because Yeravam ben Nevat, right, in the 8th century BCE, set up calves and said the same thing Bnei Israel said in the desert, and that disproved Torah, why doesn't all the Avodah Zarah they worship also disprove Torah? Jews have been violating the Torah ever since the Torah has been given. But let's try to understand his logic. Right? Yeravam ben Nevat felt that if I set up these calves and they worship God, the God of Israel, the God who took us out of Egypt, by looking at these calves, that is a safety net over worse things. What was worse at that time? Baal worship. You know what Baal worship? That's hardcore Mizrah. It's very popular in Israel. Prophets like Hosea and Amos spoke against it. Ahav, Izebel brought Baal worship very heavily into Israel. Eliyahu Navi made that big tekis up in Har Carmel against it, right? When Baal worship is very heavily observed in Israel, maybe Eliel worship is a safety net. You get it? Let me at least have them worship God through these Eliels. Because if they don't worship the Eliels, they worship Baal. Right? Get that? Look, I don't think this is very much unlike a lot of what the Reform movement did in the 1830s, 1820s, even in Germany and in Hungary. They felt the Reform movement will be a safety net against conversion to Christianity altogether, right? Okay, you know what it ended up being? It wasn't a safety net, it was a gateway. So that's what Hosea says. Hosea tells the people that Baal worship is not a safety net. Don't make Baal worship to be the official worship. Stand firm. Yeah, you may lose people to Baal as a result. But if you work, go down to Baal worship, that's going to be a gateway to Baal worship, not a safety net. Understand that clearly, okay? Okay, so Shituf is considered Avodah Zarah for a Jew, but I've been telling you now for about 2 weeks, it's not considered Avodah Zarah for Ben Noach. Okay? Everyone clear with that? So, a few weeks ago, when we were talking about religious Zionism, I gave you the two different sides about whether we can consider Israel to be racist, to be possible the same or not. Remember that? So, if you know enough to not, to say, what would be the clearest sign for us to say we are closer today to the coming of Mashiach? We're moving in that direction. Someone maybe 70 or 80 years ago in Europe said, we have never been further away from the coming of Mashiach than what's going on now, right? Right? So, all right, so I should hope that everybody here is going to say the same thing, right? Because we're in an institution that appreciates religious Zionism, right? But you should know that there are many Jews, not just in Turkey, certainly all of Satmar, and many other Jews, some of whom live in Israel, some who don't live in Israel. But there are many Jews who feel that the state of Israel is moving us further and further and further away from a messianic arrival, even whether it's run by former Jews or not. Because what do we need in Israel before we can have a political movement there? So we need three things to take place. You've heard of the three oaths? We talked about this some, I think, three oaths. One oath is that Jews do not rebel against the nations of the world in establishing a place, a political movement where Jews can return. Two, do not go there until God makes it clear that He's calling you. First one is called Lo Yimradu Bagoyim. This is a Gemara at the end of Suvas, and I'm surprised. Didn't your Rebbeim teach you this Gemara in Israel? Every yeshiva teaches this Gemara for 2 or 3 weeks while you're in Israel. No? Three is an oath that's given to the nations. The oath is, while the Jews are keeping their two oaths, do not subjugate them in the lands of their dispersal. If the oaths are dependent on each other, on one another, I can forgive the Jews in 1948 for establishing a political movement because the Gentiles of the world didn't keep their oath. Right? With the Holocaust that just happened. You see? What historical events could possibly indicate that we have kept the other two oaths also? Even if you say that this is not an Agadic Gemara, it's actually a Halachic Gemara. The Rambam doesn't bring it down. But even if you want to say that this is a halachic piece of Gemara, anyone know what Book of Tanakh, piece of the oaths are based on? One of you? You weren't listening now, you weren't listening then. Every yeshiva teaches this. Ema Bodim Smecha, you're not learning this? Shalvin, KB1, they're all doing it. I need a whole curriculum for the yeshivas to teach this. Shira Shirin? Ishpat Yisven and Osi Rishon? No. Spending all this money? You're getting out of it. I can't continue in Hebrew because none of you would follow. Do something. Do something on your own. Do something.
What's going on in the Jewish world?
I don't know. There are three oaths. There are three psukim in Shir HaShirim. All these same exact I take this oath. Let's see what the oath is. This is a Talmudic discussion that confused me. That's super what the three oaths are. Don't rebel against the Goyim and your political aspirations. Don't set up a beachhead, a home in Israel, unless God clearly is calling you to do so. And three, the nations of the world, don't subjugate them while they're keeping their oaths. Right? If the oaths are dependent on each other, on one another, then all bets are off. They didn't keep theirs, we don't have to keep ours. But we have kept ours. How do we know we didn't rebel against the nations? I don't know, it depends on what our commentaries say. What two events of the 20th century might actually point in that direction? The UN partition plan of 1947, there was a vote here in New York.
Oh, right.
The majority of the nations in the world said that Israel deserves to have a partition. Or better yet, the League of Nations. Or even better than that, the Balfour Plan of 1917. Right? None of those were ever ratified. Right? The partition plan wasn't ratified either. That was rejected. There is no. Because every time they say illegal settlements and illegal occupation, no such thing. That land has never been defined. The last defining world body to identify an area was the League of Nations in 1923, and that is, forget about that, the Balfour Declaration included all of Israel and all of Jordan as a Jewish homeland. And when he locked off 78% of it and gave it to the Hashemite kingdom, he asked King Hussein, the current King Hussein's grandfather, what do you want to call your nation? He said, I want to call it Palestine. was told, you can't call Palestine. Palestine is the name of the Jewish homeland.
So,
that's what Winston Churchill told the king of Jordan. He's the foreign minister at the time. So we didn't go against, we didn't rebel against the guy. And the only question is, did God call us? Where did God call us? A hand coming out, writing on the sky. Here I am, I'm God, I'm calling you. Satmar Rebbe, in his book by Yoel Moshe, wrote that in his opinion, the Holocaust was a punishment for Zionism. You're not supposed to come to Israel until I call for you. Zionism started in the 1880s, the 1950s. So you look for a homeland, okay, you'll die in there. There is another Satmar rabbi named Yisachar Teichtel. Does that name ring a bell to anybody? He's wrote a book called Eim Avon and Smecha, right? It's been translated even. It's very rare for a book written by a Hungarian Hasidic rabbi to be translated into English. It's very popular in Israel. It's usually given out at Shalvin, KY dinners. I don't know if any of you went there. But it's given out at yeshiva dinners. It was written by a Satmar rabbi, not a Satmar Rebbe, of course, but a Satmar rabbi, who changed his tune after he spent some time in some concentration camps. He wrote his thoughts after the war in 1951. He published his book. It's called Eim Avon and Smecha. It's about religious Zionism, and he thinks the exact opposite of Satmar Rebbe. And they knew each other. Their pictures are almost interchangeable. They knew each other. And he said he thinks it's the exact opposite. God is now calling us. He's driving us home to our homeland, and we're not coming along. Right? After 2,000 years, God is finally calling us to Shavu'banu with Vulam. There was no white paper in 1915 or 1917. Jews had come, 2 million Jews had come to Israel at that time. They were invited to come. It's just that they were told by everyone not to come. The Reform movement, the conservative movement, were vehemently against Israel at the time.
Really?
Very strong, because they said that is xenophobic, it's parochial, the new Israel is all around the world, that's why they call Shul's temples. We have a temple where we live here in America, we don't need Israel, and most of the Orthodox were also against it. Religious Zionists, but the bottom line is that the oath that we're supposed to wait for God to call us, I don't know. Depends on your religious outlook. I like to say Rashid Smichas to the same because I think God has called us this way for 100 years. Let me just have, just well, I'm going to end with one anecdote, but I'm going to shut the tape. I think.